This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Susan, one thing I noticed this week, I was downtown in the daylight hours, which is a little bit unusual for me. I was amazed at how many construction cranes you see on the Chicago skyline. And maybe you see it every day and you just, you know, you kind of take it for granted. You don't notice it. But for someone who's not there every day in the daytime, It's kind of shocking to see all those cranes. There are 52. I think I read the other day there's something like 52 construction cranes, more than any other major city in the United States now.
Wow. You know, that I didn't realize there. I knew that there were quite a few of them, but 52 seems almost excessive. But I know that they're just getting a lot of them are getting all geared up for summer construction of the roadways and finishing up the Jane Byrne, flyover and wow, lots going on in downtown here, and I'm here a lot of times at night, too, so, yeah.
Yeah, it really surprised me. It reminded me, I was in Malaysia many years ago. I'm going back probably 15, 20 years ago, and you looked across the skyline of Kuala Lumpur, and it was the same way. I mean, it was just everywhere you looked, there were construction cranes. So it speaks to the vibrancy of the city and all of the residential space that is being added with this, because I think most of the cranes are indeed working on residential buildings, if I recall correctly from what I read. Anyway, nice to visit with you. We'll check in with you for the headlines coming up at about 5:30 here.
Sounds good.
Susan Berkus on duty in the WGN newsroom. Max Armstrong with you this morning on the Saturday morning show. It is Earth Day. We'll talk about that a little bit later, and we're going to talk about the markets coming up here. David Hightower studies China rather intently, pays attention to what's going on over there, visits there often, and he'll be along next here on the Saturday morning show to visit on that very subject and what's happening in our markets right now. Our market guest this weekend, who came by our studios during the week, David Hightower, the Hightower Report. He watches China closely. He's been over there many, many times. Not only to lecture, not only to consult, but also to gather information. In our visit, I talked with him about all that's been going on relative to North Korea and China's involvement. What has been happening there? That hasn't hurt our relationship with China, has it?
Well, you might consider that it improved a little bit. I know the problems with North Korea, but there's just overwhelming support against that. So I'm more concerned about whether China is growing or not growing. And recent oil imports show that we're still pegged right up near record high. So that's what I look at.
Months ago, I asked you that question about slowing growth in the Chinese economy, and it was everybody's point of discussion in the marketplace, how much China was slowing down, and you said it was, in essence, much ado about nothing. You're still not worried about it, I gather.
I still feel that way. You look at the numbers, you look at the physical commodities and what they're consuming. You know, you might get a slowdown in imports because they get internal stocking issues, but the base metals and other commodities tell me that they're still chugging along. Not great, not fast, but certainly enough to consume commodities.
That commodity mix will vary from time to time. And I think, for example, of the spurt of grain sorghum business we did with them several months ago. Is there anything happening otherwise in terms of the agriculture commodities, whether you're talking about grains or meats?
Well, I mean, we continue to do chicken little when it comes to the Chinese soybean import pace, and it has not relented. In fact, I think we actually saw a 600,000-ton purchase of corn. When you look at the Brazilian exports maybe stepping in and garnering some of our market share, you know, that almost exactly equals what Chinese demand has been. So if you took all the South American supply and push it over to China, we still have the rest of the world and ethanol and feed demand that's growing. So we have an oversupply problem, but I don't think it's as bad as what the markets are giving credit for.
We continue to wait for that pendulum to swing where the United States would be
a lesser supplier to China with the Brazilian shipments going in there. Has that happened?
No, but I think that it's moderating, and it is an issue. You can't deny that. It's a potential problem, and we probably haven't hit the period of highest supply with coming into the North American crop.
We heard this week that Mexico has been talking with Argentina and trying to put together some kind of a trade deal. When our U.S. Grains Council officials were down there about a month or so ago, they said that the Mexicans kept talking about Plan B, that they might have to turn increasingly to South America. Is that anything that should be worrisome to us?
Well, we think our Congress is bad. When you combine Mexico and Argentina together, I'm not too sure they can move quickly on something like that. And we're close, and those trade relations have been set up for a long time.
So, indeed, the proximity is going to continue to work in our favor, most likely.
Yeah, and again, overall economic activity is really what the issue is. And we've seen the dollar decline. And we've seen the dollar decline when we thought we were strong in our economy, when we thought we were raising interest rates. And that's a very significant sign that the dollar is going to weaken this year.
We saw the president weighed in this week on that dairy dispute with Canada, saying he's on the side of the farmer. We haven't heard much of that from the White House yet. Is that a friendly signal in terms of trade matters for the United States agriculture industry?
Well, you know, I think he softened a lot of his aggressive trade threats, and particularly with China. I mean, one would have thought that those would have had a lot of basis. So I think what he claims is a negotiating position, and that's, if you read his book, he comes out with really bold claims, sets the table for the negotiation, and then I think relents to get a deal.
It is interesting to watch, isn't it, what's going on in these geopolitical things. I want to come back to that for just a moment. Does that have the prospect at all of derailing our ag trade?
Well, I think it has softened it already, and it's softened the economy simply because that Trump windfall or the Trump reflation, the hope of tax reform and infrastructure spending, unfortunately, it's taken a backseat in timing and potentially passage. And to me, that's the dominant geopolitical issue.
Back to the supply side and taking a look at what's happening here with planting season. We're still early in the game. There's no reason to worry, is there?
No, I don't think so. And when you look at how early we've moved and moved the crop forward, and you see that tendency year after year to try and get in the corn. So it is early. There is the expectation of less corn, more soybeans. But again, I think they tilt toward getting a little bit more corn than we anticipate from early estimates.
We manage to get it planted every year. I mean, somehow, after all of the nervousness about it, why does the trade get so nervous anymore?
Well, I guess it's old habits, and it should not be, because when you look at how quick we can plant, it really should lower the threat of that. I mean, you really need an unusual amount of rain in order for that to happen.
As we look ahead toward this next week's planting progress report, what's your feeling on how far along the corn planting will be? Have you formulated any ideas yet, or is it a little bit early?
No, it's a little early, but I also think they'll probably not pick up the pace. I mean, when you look at the coming week, this is one of those numbers that should jump up from, say, from high single digits into the mid-20, 28% levels. But I think we might be a little below that.
What else are you looking at here in terms of what's going on in the commodity markets? Is there anything else that really is top of mind for you?
Well, I think the oil price structure, when we look at demand, we look at supply. I know we're seeing an increase in shale oil production, and we're the world's reserve supply now, so we get a little bit frantic over that in terms of whether prices will fall. But I think we're assimilating at a higher level, and that takes that deflationary threat. So we don't want to see large grain supply and seeing the rest of the commodity markets plunging, because then that can drag us down even further than we should go.
Have you been surprised how quickly the shale oil industry has tried to rebuild?
Well, no. Contrary to what a lot of people in this country think, capitalism and economic supply and demand work. And so not only have we resurrected production, but we may begin to cap it off a little bit if prices don't go higher from the $50 barrel level.
But we need to keep an eye on that oil price, as you've pointed out on many occasions. It's one of the first things you check each day, I gather.
Yeah, and it's the EKG of the world economy. That's what I like to look at, more so than the copper market anymore.
David Hightower, the Hightower Report, who came to our studios this week. The Saturday morning show on WGN Radio, 22 minutes past 5 o'clock. We want to warm it up a little bit, doggone it. We need to warm these soils so that they'll be quite receptive for the corn kernels to be planted there. You know, you look at the soil temperatures, and most of northern Illinois is still in the upper 40s at that 4-inch level. Much of Iowa is in the 40s. Almost all of Iowa has soil temperatures in the 40s. Now, you get out to a line from, let's say about Kankakee, over toward La Salle, Peru, down toward Muscatine, Bettendorf, Iowa. You go south of that line, soil temps are in the low 50s. And you get into the southern part of the state, let's say from, around Decatur to Effingham on south, upper 50s and low 60s for the soil temp. So it's plenty warm down there, but really cool soil temperatures yet through Michigan. No warmer than the 40s there for the most part. And Wisconsin, Minnesota, some of the soil temps in northern Wisconsin and in Minnesota still in the 30s. So those growers would certainly like to see the temperatures warm. Healthcare remains a real concern in rural areas, and the problem that we've seen at rural hospitals has not improved. Our friend Steve Alexander has a report on that this weekend. Take it away.
Good morning, Max. I came across an article a few days ago about the crisis in rural health care, and it contained a statistic that was shocking, and I'll pass that along in just a couple of moments. And no, this is not political. It has nothing to do with repeal and replace. A recent article at Politico.com highlighted the health care crisis in rural America and how one small country town is turning things around. Joining me on the phone is Anna Gorman, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News based in Los Angeles. And the title of the story is Healthcare's New Rural Frontier. The subtitle is How an Idaho Hospital That Serves a Region with More Bears Than People is Helping Forge the Future of American Medicine. You cite a statistic that is really, to me, shocking, and that is that rural hospitals have been closing at a rate of one per month since 2010. One per month?
Yeah. That's correct. Rural hospitals have been closing rapidly. About 78 have closed since 2010 alone. And it's a combination of factors that's leading to this. Part of it is the demographics itself, that there just aren't as many people living, proportionally, there just aren't as many people living in rural America. Only 14% of the population is living in 72% of the nation's land. So that's part of the demographic problem, is that, you know, without the population, a small community rural hospital just can't survive. Another part is the population that does remain, a lot of them are older and sicker and poorer. And the government just really does not reimburse well if through Medicare or through Medicaid. So hospitals have trouble surviving if they can't pay their bills, and they just can't do so if all of their patients are on government insurance programs. And the other kind of problem that rural healthcare is facing is that they just don't have the workforce. So there just aren't enough doctors who are willing to go to places like Arco, Idaho, or small towns in anywhere across the Midwest or the West.
Let's talk about the example of Arco, Idaho, and the Lost Rivers Medical Center that you focused on for your article, which again is at Politico.com. Lost Rivers was just about out of business, wasn't it?
It was. When the CEO, Brad Huerta, got in just a few years ago, the hospital was bankrupt. They had $7,000 in the bank, and they were actually bouncing paychecks. One nurse said that on payday, she would rush to the bank to cash her check because she didn't know if it would bounce if she waited till the next day. So what the CEO did is he got a bond passed to be able to bring the hospital out of bankruptcy. But then what he did is he used that money to invest in new technology and to try some different ways to provide health care. One of those ways was through telemedicine, which is basically this thing that's being used across America, not just in rural health care, where if a doctor is not present in the facility, you can communicate by video link or by phone. And so they started using telemedicine more. They also started trying to convince patients to be there. So they bought a brand new CT machine, so patients didn't have to travel to a bigger hospital about an hour away to get a CT scan. And he started bringing in more specialists on a rotating basis, including a cardiologist, which was really important for this population. So the fact that they could see their specialist right there in their community rather than drive an hour away was really important to them. So he was able to turn the hospital around.
Well, you have to give credit to Mr. Huerta, the CEO, and his sales pitch on that $5.5 million bond issue. Would you like to describe his pitch?
Sure. He basically went around the community and played to their interests. And so a lot of them were drinkers, right? A lot of the community drank. And so he said, look, is this worth 1 6-pack of beer a month to keep your hospital open? Other people like to watch a lot of movies. So he said, look, and they don't have a video store in town. There's a lot of, you know, shuttered buildings. There's no movie theater or anything. So people use the Redbox videos. And he said, is this worth 2 videos a month to get save this hospital for your community? And he and his COO, they just went around to the community, people, person by person, and convinced the town to pass a bond. And it was pretty incredible. It worked. And he was able to get this a significant amount of money, $5.5 million for this hospital's survival.
Did you get a sense of what was learned in ARCO that could be applied to small town hospitals all across the country?
Sure. Well, the CEO, Huerta, would say, maintain your independence. He said he did not want to be purchased by a larger corporate hospital in one of the other bigger towns nearby because he worried that then Lost River would become, quote-unquote, a Band-Aid in the desert, and that people would just be stabilized and moved on to bigger hospitals. So he would say, maintain your independence. I think the other lesson to be learned is to not be afraid to try new things, whether that's a telepharmacy so that people can get their medications in their communities even if there isn't a pharmacist in town, or whether it's trying remote patient monitoring, whether it's bringing in new technology. I think the idea is to not be afraid to try new things. And to learn from others around the country who are doing these things. There are lots of examples of innovation in rural healthcare across the country.
The title of the article is Healthcare's New Rural Frontier, How an Idaho Hospital That Serves a Region with More Bears Than People is Helping Forge the Future of American Medicine. The writer is Anna Gorman, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. And Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Gorman, along with Steve Alexander there. Interesting report. And we've seen a combination of those approaches taken in our part of the country. Quite often you will see a bigger hospital in one of the larger cities reaching out and taking over some of those challenged hospitals because they will not survive on their own. And quite often it is very successful. It leads to significantly improved locally administered health care through that hospital. Not always, but sometimes it can make a big difference. There's more coming up on the Saturday morning show. In the next half hour, we'll talk about that trade dispute with Canada with a gentleman who is a journalist and a farmer and a market analyst north of the border, and we'll also talk about Earth Day. Back on the Saturday morning show on WGN Radio Chicago, we'll talk trade for a moment. And who knew that trade as a dispute would flare up between the United States and, well, not China at the moment, not Mexico at the moment, but our good trading partner to the north, Canada. Here to discuss this and how it moved into the discussion between world leaders this week is a farmer who is also a journalist, who is also a market analyst in Ontario, Canada, Philip Shaw, who joins us here on WGN Radio. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Max. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You bad guys up there, you've now drawn the wrath of our president. Are you a little bit surprised that Trump has taken aim at you guys, you Canadian farmers?
I was surprised, Max, simply because generally over a period of years, Canadians and Americans get along really well on this North American continent. We had a dust-up a few times in 1814 when we burned your White House down, and you came marching through just a few years before that. But generally, we have a good trading relationship. And, you know, we have the biggest one in the world. You know, we share bilateral trade of about $2 billion that passes our borders in goods and services daily. And up until just a year or two ago, we were your biggest export market for agricultural products. We are very used to dealing with our American friends up here, and what was unusual about the words from the president the other day were they were so public, and you know, they were pretty difficult, and they came as an aside to him talking about a memorandum on something else. And so it was surprising, and I was surprised that it was as pointed as it was, and our prime minister responded in kind.
There have been those border irritants in the past. I know our wheat growers, for example, in Montana and North Dakota have never been terribly pleased about imports coming in from Canada. Our pork producers have, at times have been irritated by shipments of pork coming south of the border, as they feel that your producers, fewer in number, are taking advantage of the larger population of the United States. So certainly trade has been an irritant to some, but now it's dairy. And there were some changes made in your milk pricing policy, were there not?
Yeah, there were some changes made just a couple of years ago in Ontario regarding a particular ingredient, milk ingredient, that was changed. And it had to do with largely with the demand for butter that took place, and it's caused a little bit of a problem, not only with this current president, President Trump, but it also caused a problem with President Obama, who brought this up with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau before he left office.
It is alleged that there are high tariffs that have been put in place in Canada to limit the ability of shipments to come in. Supply is managed. I mean, that's nothing new. I remember, oh, good Lord, 20, 25 years ago, maybe longer than that, some of our U.S. producers saying, we need to do what the Canadians are doing, manage the supply so that there isn't such a surplus. There are some internal mechanisms that do benefit milk producers in Canada, correct?
Clearly there is. But you know, Canada is a big place, but it also has some very diverse agricultural regions. You have the vast Western Canadian area that grows a lot of grain and raises a lot of livestock. Here in Ontario, you have a lot of corn and soybeans, just like you would in Michigan and Indiana and Ohio, and you have livestock as well. But in Quebec and Ontario, in Quebec, which is mostly French-speaking, you have a preponderance of dairy that's in Canada. So the dairy industry is focused on the eastern part of the country, and the rules that have developed over a period of time had to do with a marketing system that did manage supply. And with the Canada-U.S. trade agreement, free trade agreement in the early 1990s, we had a free trade arrangement with the United States. And, of course, that was morphed into the NAFTA agreement that was negotiated by President Clinton and Prime Minister Chrétien many years ago. So, you know, there's always problems that come up with regard to this, and this is just another one.
You know, you reminded me about that free trade agreement that we had between our nations alone before NAFTA came on the scene. And if I'm not mistaken, the late Clayton Yeider, a former president of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, former Ag Secretary, former United States Trade Representative, negotiated for our side that agreement. And I wondered when he passed a few days ago, you know, what he would have thought about all of this unwinding of NAFTA. Is it possible, though, that maybe even Clayton Yeider would have said, after 24 years, Phil, maybe there's room for some tweaking in what has been the North American Free Trade Agreement?
I think he would have. And Simon Reisman, who was a negotiator on our side, maybe he said he would have as well. However, this was all brought up by the election of President Trump, because President Trump campaigned on this. And you know, there was even pressure on the Democratic side, because Bernie Sanders was talking about this ad nauseum, and he forced Mrs. Clinton to come over to his side a little bit more on that. But Mr. Trump has brought this up, and that's how it's come to the fore. But you just can't tear up NAFTA. There's a lot of legal agreements, international trade agreements that are set in place, and it will take time to do that. And there will be a negotiation. You know, Canada is the largest export market for 35 U.S. states. We have a huge economic impact on parts of the United States, and it's something that just shouldn't be taken lightly by our American friends. I know from our standpoint, we think about how the Americans respond to almost everything we do. And, you know, our prime minister said that, this is more a function of politics than it is good agricultural policy from our American friends. But all nations around the world try to protect their agriculture to some extent. And that's one thing that Canada has maintained through all the different free trade agreement that we've had, not only with the United States and Mexico, but also the European Union, which we just signed on just a month or two ago.
Yes, Prime Minister Trudeau, I believe, said this week, every nation defends its agriculture industry. And I think there is some truth to that. The line of defense is bigger in some instances than it is in others. And ideally, we'd all love to see a level playing field and free trade, I think. I guess it just doesn't work that way, does it?
Well, it's difficult in some nations of the world that have had famine before and know about food security and things of that nature and worry about their food supply. In North America, all the consumers go to bed at night and they never think about that food won't be in the grocery store tomorrow. But, you know, where I live, you know, we have American corn coming across our borders every day, and sometimes we get too much corn here and we ship it back into the United States. And there's just, you know, Michigan trucks here in Ontario all the time, and there's Ontario trucks in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and places like that. So, you know, I think that we've proven over a period of time that we can get along in the agricultural trade as well as the greater trade has been good for both countries, and we'll get through this. But, yes, it was a very public and almost somewhat of a very aggressive stance taken by the American president toward Canada, which generally isn't thought of much in the United States, especially when it comes to trade. Because when you ask Americans about trade, typically they think about China and Japan and places like that. And sometimes we have a much bigger trade surplus with you than those other countries, but we never seem to get noticed. So that was quite a departure when President Trump said those things the other day.
He's about 10 days away from even having an agriculture secretary on duty. We do believe that coming up a week from Monday, we will get the quick confirmation by the United States Senate for Sonny Perdue. But maybe President Trump was just trying to get the attention of all concerned before we start to do a little bit of negotiating on the North American Free Trade Agreement. And as you've seen on other matters, sometimes he's very strident in his initial comments, but then after he is advised by his advisors, including many from business and industry, he softens that position, takes a little bit of a different stance. Do you think that could happen this time?
I will leave that impression up to you, Max. I find as a Canadian, I really should never comment on the politics of the United States. However, I will say this. From a Canadian perspective, I think that the United States president should be respected for what he thinks. And I will leave you to interpret how he thinks and the American farmers to how he thinks. But we have great respect for what our American friends mean to us as a country. And when the American president says some things that, you know, that we don't really care for, like we said the other day, I still think we should respect what he says, because I think in some ways it's just the way he goes about doing business. But I don't know that yet. But, you know, I think it's important that we respect what he says and we'll try to work out a deal that is good for both countries. Because, like you say, our trading relationship is vast. It is vast, and it helps both countries. You know, cattle that are raised or born in Canada are sometimes raised in the United States, and in the same time, sometimes they're born in the U.S. and they're raised in Canada. Sometimes they're fed in Canada and slaughtered in the United States, and vice versa. So we have an integrated market, and I think that we can get past this. But, yes, we respect what the president said. I think it's important as Canadians to realize what he said, and we're just going to, you know, we'll go with what our prime minister said, too, and they're preparing for a tough negotiation.
Well, maybe I'm a little bit naive. that has been the case at times in the past, but I think of our long-lasting, powerful friendship across that border to the north, and how much you have meant to us, standing by us in various geopolitical skirmishes around the world, and hopefully how much we've meant to you. And I'd like to think that this is going to continue to be one of the strongest friendships on the globe. Thank you for helping sort it out with some good common sense from Ontario, Phil. We appreciate it.
It is certainly a pleasure, Max, and I hope to chat with you again.
Philip Shaw, he's a farmer in Ontario, Canada. He's also a journalist. His writings can be seen on DTN and on Twitter, by the way. And he's a very astute analyst of the markets, including those traded here in Chicago. There's more coming up on the Saturday Morning Show on WGN Radio. Coming up on 10 before 6 on WGN Radio. Visiting there with Philip Shaw. He is on Twitter. Agridome is how you find him on Twitter. That guy has like 11,400 followers. Well, it's easy to understand because of his communication ability and the tweets that he puts out. Many of them are related to grain production in the United States. I'm on Twitter, too. Look for me. In fact, I just retweeted something that Philip tweeted. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Armstrong. Saturday morning show, this portion of which is brought to you by Wink Products Company. It's Earth Day, and I thought it would be a good time to talk about what farmers are doing and have been doing to care for the land. And a longtime leader in the soil and water conservation districts of the United States joins us on the line this morning, past president of the National Association of Conservation Districts, Gene Schmidt, LaPorte County area of northern Indiana. Gene, are you in the midst of planting yet there around your community?
We're getting close to that. There may be just a little bit already transpiring, Max. We got a shower yesterday, but we're maybe a couple days off when ground conditions will support that.
When you look at the calendar and the current date, this is about when you want to be in the field, isn't it?
This is a time that we shoot for by the calendar, and you look for Mother Nature's blessings, and if the conditions are right and the calendar says go, you try to make something happen.
This is Earth Day, and I get kind of amused when they talk about Earth Day, which has been around, I believe, for less than 50 years. I think the first one was in the early 70s. We'll be hearing about it all day today, but it occurs to me that farmers and other landowners were ahead of this game by a few decades. Our soil and water conservation districts in the United States, correct me if I'm wrong, were established at least 80 years ago, weren't they?
That's exactly true, Max, and that was exactly what we're trying to accomplish in that process, was taking care of the soil, and thanks that it was recognized, the Earth Day, and there's a week following here close by that goes right along with that, Max. It's Stewardship Week, and it truly is, and a lot of churches across the country will actually take some soils and bless them on the Sundays between the last week of April and the first week of May, and in that same accordance, so it's the right thing to do.
I remember as a boy seeing local farmers in our community in southwestern Indiana who really took this soil and water conservation matter seriously. And my dad worked with those guys, and he admired what they were doing and copied what they were doing. And I remember the sense of pride of putting in some kind of a practice or a structure that was going to limit erosion. I remember riding with my dad down past a structure that he had put in the field, and we were keeping the topsoil in place. It was no longer washing down the ditch and into the road where we were losing that valuable topsoil. And that point of pride is still very much there, isn't it?
There is that, Max, and you'll hear so many times, you know, farmers will make the comment that they've strived to try to provide the opportunity to leave this soil better than the shape that we found it in. And it's those conservation practices, and it's doing just as you said, Max. It's looking at driving down the road, looking at different practices, and even as we've surveyed across the country, we have some data of the conservation activity that's transpired for those folks that worked with the NRCS office and back in early times, the SES office, Max, and did some cost share, but that's the only ones that we had record of, is those that took some dollars to help make that happen. But there's so many folks, as you speak of, your father, that just drove down a road and saw a practice that looked like it was going to work, and so much more of that's done that we don't have record of. So there's been tremendous activity, and it truly is that pride that those folks have taken to do a better job.
You mentioned NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and its predecessor, the SCS, the Soil Conservation Service. These were and are an agency of the federal government, and it has been a partnership that has worked pretty well through the years. Is it still intact, Gene?
It is intact, Max, and that's what we talk about. It's the partnerships throughout the country that provides the opportunity to get conservation on the land, and we call that the locally led process, and it's a process that takes individual landowners, operators, in partnership with the AG folks that have the technical assistance to apply the right practice in the right opportunity in the landscape that they have to accomplish those effects that improve both the landscape and the environment.
When the Farm Bill is passed, and they'll be starting to work on another one fairly soon, there will be some provisions in there, presumably, that will help to foster conservation. There's always a bit of a budget struggle, I know, for those. Would the conservation effort on our farms falter if Uncle Sam weren't helping out to some extent?
It's a big consideration, Max, when we look at the budget. We know that when dollars are tough, you have to make the right decisions. But when we're looking at the technical assistance that owners and operators get across the country that help provide the knowledge in the background that whatever practice we would choose to do, that we're doing it the right way and we're making the most impact with the dollars that are available. And that when we look at discretionary funding within the budget, in the USDA's budget, that's one of the items that's so critical to us. And without that technical assistance, those local folks that have the knowledge and background, the engineering degree and that kind of scenario that gives us that background that we can install the right practices that have the biggest impact. And that's so critical. And that's one thing that we've been out in Washington walking the halls, Max, and helping those folks understand how critical that phase of it is.
One provision that has been very popular, of course, with the wildlife folks, with hunters and others, has been the Conservation Reserve Program. The CRP went into effect, I believe, back in the 85 Farm Bill. It has, it's changed a little bit through the years. The acreage amount has changed. Colin Peterson, powerful Democrat congressman from Minnesota, wants to jack up the amount of acreage in the CRP rather substantially, I understand. Would that be good, Gene, if he wanted to raise it as much as he's talking about?
We always look at the opportunity, Max, if it's the right thing to do, to put those acres into some kind of a conservation program, based on the best impact for the dollar spent. When you look at the budget constraints that we have, if that was to take place and they took dollars from other conservation programs under the Farm Bill and conservation titles, Title II, Max, that if so many of the other programs, some of the 319 grants we work with in partnership with the EPA, the EQIP program and so many of the other programs, if those dollars are shaved back to provide the dollars to get more CRP acres, we really think it would probably hamper the amount of conservation that we can get on what we call working lands. That's the lands that are productive, and that's the lands that we're trying to make sure they're not fragile. So when they talk about feeding the world in 2050, that we have the capability of making that happen.
The pie is only so big, then, you're saying.
Yes, and again, realizing that the budget constraints and only X amount of dollars available, Max, we just want to make sure that whatever dollars we have available to impact the conservation efforts across this country, that we get the biggest impact with the dollars that are available.
Gene Schmidt, past president of the National Association of Conservation Districts. He's over in northwest Indiana, east of Valparaiso, on east of Wanata, a little bit south of Union Mills, Hanna, Indiana.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.